Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Chris, it's a great to be back in the studio with you. We're just getting past Halloween here and All Saints Day. So a great time to celebrate. Did you do anything special for those holy day of All Saints?
Wait, what's All Saints Day? I thought it was Halloween. What is this about candy?
Well, Halloween is All Hallows Eve, which means it's the eve of preparation for All Saints Day.
I know that. I'm just kidding.
I know. Did you get any candy? Or did you just give it away?
Just a giver.
Okay, good.
All right, so we're going to start this week with... Neuroscientists generally believe that consciousness exists exclusively in the brain. A paradigm shift may be coming as evidence emerges to the contrary. One piece of evidence are near-death experiences where people across the world report having out-of-body experiences where they feel as though they're watching their body from above as
right.
their
There's
doctors are racing.
Books out there about
yeah,
that.
Right.
And articles.
Resuscitate them. Right. But the more robust, harder to ignore evidence comes from a phenomenon called terminal lucidity.
Okay, you're going to have to unpack that for me, Chris.
Okay, terminal lucidity is a brief return to mental clarity that occurs in some people shortly before death. This includes people whose brains are no longer functional because of advanced dementia, meningitis, brain tumors, or other mental disorders.
Right.
The phenomena didn't have a name until 2009, but case studies reach back in detailed descriptions to the 18th century. Terminal lucidity can last from a few minutes to a few hours. It almost always is followed by a complete mental relapse and death within a day or two.
Interesting.
This is leading more scientists to believing that consciousness, because you've got a non-functioning brain that becomes lucid, that consciousness can exist independent of the brain. Is terminal lucidity proof of the existence of a soul?
Proof, I wouldn't say it's proof, but it's definitely pointing in that direction. I think it's another element that we could say that, yes, there is a human soul. And I think it's really interesting from this slightly different vantage point, Chris. I see it as an expression of God's mercy on the soul, that he gives us that one last moment of lucidity before death to
bring
see
closure.
If there's... Yeah, bring closure. Like, do I need to forgive someone? Do I need to seek forgiveness? Do I need to get something in order? And I've seen that in a few cases as well. So it's interesting to put a name to it.
Yeah. But think about it, though. If it's from an incapacitated brain, scientifically, then this must be coming from somewhere else.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, there could be. A lot of times people are supposedly brain dead or they're in a coma. But they, when they wake up from it, they will recount that I heard everything. I knew what was going on. And that may be an indicator that there's a diffusion of consciousness not, that goes beyond the brain. We have nerve endings throughout our entire body. We have our blood, and we're all alive. The interesting thing about death, and when you study this from a bioethics standpoint and from Catholic theology, the moment of death is not necessarily brain death. The moment of death is when the soul leaves the body, from a philosophical and theological perspective. And there is an immediate change in the body when that moment happens. Doctors can tell you all about it, but there'll be one moment the person is there, and then the next moment they can tell.
Their animating spirit is gone.
The animating spirit is gone. That's what the soul is. Now, and science is catching up with this, but we know this from a human experience down through the millennia. Okay, so it's fascinating to see these elements of science catching up and seeing what we've already known and what we know from philosophy and theology, but putting a name to it.
Well, a corollary to this was another study that I read that just recently came out from the University of Virginia, finding that near-death experiences often bring deep spiritual shifts, not shockingly, and can also strain close relationships. So the research piece was published in the Psychology of Consciousness.
What do they mean by the straining of close relationships?
I'm about to tell you. So they surveyed 167 people who had near-death experiences.
Okay.
These were episodes reported by people close to death, including the out-of-body experience,
right.
meeting deceased loved ones, or feeling overwhelming peace.
Roughly, by the way, 1 in 6 critically ill patients report these
near
experiences.
Near-death experiences.
Yes.
Yeah.
So more than 1 in 5 of the participants of these 167 people said post the near-death experience that their relationships with their family, friends, and people got worse after this experience. And another 22% reported a divorce or a breakup. I can see where this near-death experience shifts your belief foundation.
Well, in your whole value system.
Yeah, and it makes you harder to connect with the people that you previously connected with.
Right.
So, yeah, what are your thoughts about that?
Is an interesting thing. It ties back to that gospel passage where Jesus talks about how he didn't come for peace. He came for division. You know, a mother-in-law would be divided against her daughter-in-law and father against son. So I think when we come to the truth, sometimes it breaks us off from relationships. And this is very different from what we're seeing in our cancel culture. Okay. There's a tendency that we're seeing in our culture where you don't agree with someone, you just shut them off. We're not talking about that. We're talking about, like, if I'm living a lie and all of a sudden I come to realize the truth, I realize these other people in the lie, it's going to create a separation naturally. It's going to create a break. I think that's probably what's happening in these near-death experiences. It's not that you're canceling other people because you don't like their point of view. It's just that you're not sharing the same point of view anymore. You've encountered the truth and your value system changes.
Yeah, 22% though of these folks getting divorced at post the near-death experience
is
a little
kind of bizarre.
Yeah, bizarre.
That's not 22% that are getting divorced. It's 22% that are having a major change in a relationship.
No, this was an additional 22% of the people in that study, the 167
right.
post near-death experience had a divorce shortly thereafter, blaming their near-death experience because they just couldn't relate to the person that they had, their foundation of their life had been on before.
That is really interesting.
Yeah.
We'd have to unpack that data a little bit more and see like the specific case studies and like what's really going on there. But yeah, that's fascinating data.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires.
A man urinated on the altar of confession of St. Peter's Basilica on Friday, October 10th. This is not the first time this year that a vandal has attacked the altar from which the Pope says Mass. In February, a man climbed on top of the altar and threw 6 candelabras that were on the altar to the ground. Also in June of 2023, a Polish man approached the high altar as the basilica was about to close, undressed, and climbed naked on the altar. Does a priest have to perform an act of reparation after a desecration of the altar like this? Is it necessary as part of the rite?
Yeah, typically it is, and that's exactly what happened in this case, which is it's just terrible. And you can see a little bit of copycat going on with this, too, when people hear about, oh, that was so cool. I don't know what kind of deranged mind would think that that's cool to do that type of a desecration. But yes, the church does do a rite of reparation.
And it's required?
You know, I'd have to look into canon law. I don't, the appropriate canons don't come to mind right now. But I probably so, because the Vatican did do a rite of reparation after the sacrilege which took place.
Okay, and so is every sacrilege then requiring a reparation if you're doing so on the altar, or is it does it have to rise to a certain level?
Well, obviously, an altar is a very, very sacred place because there the sacrifice of Christ takes place. But anything that is where there's a sacrilege, where you're desecrating something that is sacred, that is consecrated to God, there needs to be acts of reparation for that, and that's where like the devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus comes from. And St. Margaret Mary Alacoque, all that devotion of the Sacred Heart was about making acts of reparation to the heart of Jesus for the so many sacrileges that take place. And it's not just a sacrilege to, you know, to defecate or pee on the altar. Those are horrible things. But think also of the sacrileges of people receiving communion in a state of mortal sin, people who are making fun of Christ or the church, taking God's name in vain. Those are things that you and I sometimes do in our own life, and we're hurting the heart of Jesus. And that's where all throughout the history of the church, the saints have many times stood up and say, no, let's do acts of reparation to assuage the heart of Jesus and to make up for all these horrible things that have gone on.
Well, it makes me appreciate the protocol that you're supposed to bow before the altar. When I read this,
right.
And I did read about the act of reparation, it really does kind of bring into focus how important the altar is.
Right. No, it is. It's a central act, a place for our act of worship as Christians, as Catholics, and it is a very, very sacred thing. And as well, you know, the chalices, the holy objects that are used in the Mass, those are some of our most sacred elements. But at the same time, we can't forget the sacredness that each one of us is as a temple of the Holy Spirit. And that's where acts of violence towards other people, or acts of sexual impurity, acts of disrespect for the dignity of others, slavery, all those things are acts of violence against God and the dignity which He's given us.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
So as a follow-up to one of the recent segments we have done regarding regular pot smokers and the possibility that it may be connected to many of the mass shootings that we've witnessed in recent times, I find this interesting. The Supreme Court said on Monday, October 20th, that it will consider in its next term whether people who regularly smoke marijuana can legally own guns.
Hmm.
So regarding guns, and particularly guns in schools, I grew up in Texas, where it was extremely common in the parking lot of my high school for people to drive their trucks with the gun in the rack.
Yeah.
Right. Displayed in the back window of the truck. So, and nobody's thought twice of that. My late father-in-law, he was an avid gun collector.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he used to bring his machine gun to school.
A machine gun?
Yes. He was an antique machine gun collector.
Okay.
He wouldn't always bring that, but he always brought every day his, I guess it was a rifle for the school's gun club activities.
Okay.
So, there was never any mass shooting in any school back then.
Right.
Even in, you know, when I was going to high school in the 80s. What's changed? The large percentage.
I think there's three things that have changed.
Okay, go ahead. Tell me what you thought.
See. One is the mental health of our young people. There's been a clear breakdown in mental health. And a lot of that's coming from dysfunctional families. When you have kids who are growing up in broken situations where they don't learn how to behave properly, don't know how to regulate their emotions, that's something that's changed. When you have 41% of our children in our society that are growing up in broken families, single parent homes, that's a real problem. And the mental health crisis is real in our country. What do we need to do for that? Let's get families back together. Let's support families. Let's support marriage. And let's, you know, we'll help single families, single parent families, but we need to aspire to the ideal. That's one thing that's changed a lot. A second thing that's changed is the violence that we see in our movies as a regular course. You know, we don't think twice about a movie in which, you know, someone that gets their head blown off. You know, and we know it's CGI and things
like
that.
But that's not new. I mean, that was happening prior to the Columbine gun incident in Colorado.
But it is new. If you look at the course of history, of thousands of years of human history, never before have we had the exposure to violence that we do today on a continuous basis. You look back at movies from the 1950s and you see some cowboys beating each other up and maybe some pow, pow, you know, shooting. There's violence, but not in the same graphic way that we see today manifested in a significant portion of the movies coming out of Hollywood. And I was noticing this when I was coming back from one of the trip to Vietnam, I think. There were a lot of international movies on the plane, and I was just kind of scrolling through, and you know, 20 hours in of flight time, and I noticed that mostly the American movies, there was a lot of vulgarity and violence. A lot of the international movies, it was more dialogue. There was more kind of a feel good type of movies, except some of the Indian movies. There's some really violent ones there too. So that's just part of what we've come to get used to.
What we expect.
Yeah. And frankly, I like a shoot 'em up movie because that's, I, as a man, like you know, action, violence. But it's desensitizing us as a community. And I think a third factor that really is playing into this too is video games, especially for young men. A lot of the first shooter video games, they play a role in desensitizing us to violence, to normalizing it. You know, you got to shoot the zombies, you got to shoot people in the head, and they become more and more realistic. Now, for a person who's balanced, this does not necessarily lead to violence in the real world. But for people who are unbalanced, going back to the first point, this can sometimes lead to acting on that in the real world.
Yeah, I think the factors, to be honest, are twofold. I think it's psychotropic drugs that people weren't on before.
Certainly part of it.
The ADHD and antidepressants. And then separately, what we talked about a couple weeks ago is this high potency THC, you know, cannabis. Mm-hmm. I mean, people were smoking pot in the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s without any mass shootings, but right. This high potency is different.
Mm. I think you're right.
On the Supreme Court, you know, for various reasons, is taking this subject up.
Yeah, and I think they should. I think these are topics we need to be talking about as a society and saying, how could we do things better? How could we do it differently? We don't have to continue following these trends. I mean, Hollywood didn't always produce this type of graphic, violent movies. Maybe we could do it differently. You know, do we have to be smoking cannabis and legalizing it everywhere? Well, looking at the side effects of it, we probably should not be.
Well, when I see these yard signs about regulating guns, it's not the gun. I mean, they were brought to school for decades without a problem. Yeah. Something else has changed.
Yeah, it certainly has.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
President Trump, who fancies himself a pro-life president, announced new federal guidance on insurance coverage for IVF services. The new directive would make opting into fertility benefits similar to opting in for dental or vision.
Okay.
There's an interesting dichotomy on this subject regarding the pro-life cause. So people using IVF are not like most of those seeking abortion, seeking a way out of consequences of their own actions.
They're looking to have a child.
Right. Yeah. They are, for the most part, married couples who have an understandable desire to have children and raise them responsibly.
Sure.
And their infertility is no fault of their own. Mostly.
That's an open question. We can look at what's causing the infertility, but oftentimes it's decisions that people have made in the past that are leading to it. Not always.
Yeah, maybe.
Oftentimes.
Okay. But the reality is that most of the public has not thought about how IVF
right.
works, right? So it involves extracting eggs from ovaries, fertilizing them with sperm to create dozens of embryos.
Mm-hmm.
The most promising ones are selected for implementation. Those unselected are destroyed or put on ice for potential future use. In some cases, several eggs implant successfully, and doctors will recommend selective abortion to reduce risks to the mother and to increase chances for the remaining baby. But even a one egg, one sperm, one implantation IVF protocol is still considered morally impermissible by the Catholic Church because it replaces rather than assists the marital act.
That's
so
right.
I'm a bit torn, as I know what the church teaches and I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But my gut feels like the IVF protocol of one fertilization, one attempt at implementation is certainly understandable and seemingly would be allowable in certain instances. What are your thoughts?
I think we need to distinguish and understand a little bit better what the church teaches and why. In vitro fertilization, IVF, is a process that does not respect the dignity of the human person, and it does not respect the dignity of the marital act. And that's why it's problematic. I think the desire for children is a beautiful thing. And especially for families, couples that are struggling with infertility, you know, who've been dreaming their whole life about having a child, it's a great suffering. And I've worked with couples who are going through this, and it is really hard. It's gut-wrenching because they've had such joy and illusions about having a child, and then they find out that they're infertile or they're struggling. And so the promise of IVF is like, we'll help you have a child. And it sounds really wonderful. But when it's not respecting the dignity of the marital act, and it's not respecting the dignity of the person, because essentially you're turning a baby into a product.
Yep.
Rather than the fruit of love through God's creation, it's a byproduct of a medical process.
Yeah, I mean,
process.
There's a mindset element here, as you just alluded to, of a baby being a product rather than an unexpected gift that you are, you know, joyful to receive,
yes.
not one that you're expecting
right.
by you know, nature, by virtue of your, you know, married stance or whatever, right?
Yeah, and there are medical procedures that can help couples that are having difficulty to conceive. So, for example, there are, without going into all the specifics, there are a couple of Vatican documents that talk about medically assisted reproduction that is legitimate. But taking a fertilized egg and putting it in a petri dish and then inserting it back into the mother, it's not respecting the dignity of that human person. So let's take a look at the other ways that the church does condone, because they do respect the dignity of the person and dignity of the child.
Well, I'm very fortunate. You know, I have five children all through natural fertility ways. I feel very blessed. Yes, thanks be to God. And so I feel for folks.
I do too. And I think in those cases, there's, for example, the Paul VI Institute has done a tremendous job at helping couples with infertility to conceive. Sometimes I know many couples that have, it just take a while for their bodies to adapt to each other. And after 7 years, 10 years of marriage, that suddenly had a child. And most interesting cases, Chris, are in Jerusalem, in Bethlehem, there's a place where the Holy Family stayed after the birth of Jesus. And there's a place called the Milk Grotto. And there's a powder that comes from the wall there. It's a limestone powder that I don't know who thought of this, but like centuries ago, someone started giving it to mothers who wanted to conceive but hadn't been able to have children. And these women started ingesting it and started having babies.
So you're saying we should eat limestone?
Yeah. Well, it's from this cave where the Blessed Virgin Mary was present with Jesus. And I can't explain it from a scientific standpoint, but historically, and the fact is there's thousands of pictures in this milk grotto in Bethlehem of babies who have been conceived of mothers who were completely infertile.
Now, I've heard of Lourdes. I hadn't heard about the milk grotto.
It's really fascinating. I actually have given that to a few different mothers or women who couldn't conceive. They all have children now.
Wow. A Finnish study of 2000.
Finnish as in like Finland?
Finland.
Gotcha.
Which, by the way, means bogland, I learned.
Bogland?
Yes.
Like swamps?
Right.
Okay.
2,000 people across 84 countries reveals that men form their strongest musical memories around the age of 16, while women peak around age 19.
Huh. Interesting.
Musical memory patterns suggest men maintain lifelong connections to teenage music, while women increasingly favor recent songs as they get older.
Okay.
They call these musical memories from our teens the reminiscence bump, which is that special period when certain experiences become permanently etched in our memory. There's also a cascading bump, this was interesting to me, that shows up among younger people, particularly those under the age of 30. These individuals report meaningful connections to music released roughly 25 years before they were born, basically their parents' music.
Right, yep.
So, and interestingly, this was more consistent in women than men. Suggesting young women might be more receptive to musical influences from previous generations. So my first question to you is, what was your 16-year-old playlist, Father Daniel?
Ooh, gosh. Actually, it's really funny. It was my dad's old, you know, single play records, the mini records. He had a collection of them. And as kids, we used to listen to them all the time.
Yeah.
So like Hang On Sloopy or the Red Baron, Snoopy, the Red Baron and the Red Baron.
Okay.
Those were some of my favorite songs as a kid.
Yeah. Well, I think this, my 16-year-old playlist would have been a combination of The Cars, Van Halen, and The Cure. So some alternative, some rock, and some, I'm not even sure which genre The Cars would have fallen into, but those still, you know, resonate with me today. I think this also sheds light on why 50-year-olds think universally, you know, no matter what decade you turn 50, that their music was better because they have this connection to...
The emotional connection.
The emotional connection to when they were 16.
Right. No, I think there's something to that.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
A new Journal of Clinical Psychiatry Review concludes, that's the name of the publication, by the way.
Okay.
Concludes that finasterid, otherwise known as Propecia, can cause depression and thoughts of suicide. Apparently, concerns about depression from finasterid surfaced as early as 2002, yet it took until 2011 for the FDA to acknowledge the depression as a side effect.
Mm-hmm.
Finasterid works by blocking an enzyme that converts testosterone. So two thoughts on this one. One, isn't it sort of tragic that something as seemingly innocuous as trying to improve your hair can possibly start you on the road to a suicide?
Well, I guess I'm not going to start taking that. Even Chris, you're looking at me here and saying
it's clear that Father Daniel has not been taking finasteride.
I am hair challenged. Yes, it's getting a little thin up there on top. No, that's certainly problematic, and it opens up the broader question that, as we've talked about many times, like, why are we taking some of these drugs that have all these side effects?
Well, that's what I want to ask you about next. Is like the inference here. So if finasteride, a partial androgen blocker,
right,
may affect your mood, isn't it reasonable then to infer that stronger testosterone suppressing drugs like the ones used for gender transition could have similar and stronger mood impacts?
Well, that would seem pretty logical.
Yet the FDA says nothing about that.
Well, that shows the political power of certain lobby groups that are trying to silence certain discourse. And again, as we've talked about in this program, these are things we need to be talking about as a society. And we need scientists to be truly honest and look at the data and not just sweep things under the rug.
In another follow-up to our discussions about the recent Charlie Kirk killing, sales of the Bible soared in the weeks after his fatal shooting. 2.4 million Bibles were sold in the U.S. in September. That's a 36% jump over the same month last year in 2024.
That's incredible.
So in addition to that, Turning Point USA, Charlie Kirk's organization, reports 350,000 new student registrations and 130,000 inquiries for new college and high school chapters over the past month.
Holy smokes.
More generally, the Pew Research Center says 6 in 10 people, this is not as dramatic, but 6 in 10 people view religion positively. That's up, this is in the U.S., that's up from 5 in 10 people who view religion positively 5 years earlier. Is there a Christian awakening happening in the U.S.?
Certainly, I see it from anecdotal data. You're pointing out some broader-based statistical information, but I've seen it in many testimonies of people. This young woman that I met this morning who was reading the Bible at a country club, you know, at the entrance. My brother, who's been away from the church, not going to Mass for many years, after watching the Charlie Kirk Memorial, He's been back to Mass every Sunday, and he's getting his kids the sacraments because he said, you know, I need to do something. I need to be the spiritual leader of my family. He was moved by that. And I see that happening in a lot of places. And this is the power of the witness of one life. It's truly amazing.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.